feel free to bring it up. Any questions today?
Moshe asked Hashem to, or hinted to put Joshua in his place. Now, my question is, why did the people have a say, like they had a say when they begged the leaders to bring them King Saul?
Well, you know, if you remember, people had a say, but God did not really, God was not really very happy. I remember when they asked for a king in the book of Samuel, so Shmuel gave them a rebuke. Shmuel basically said, why are you asking for a human king? You have God as your king. And because of this, God expressed his dissatisfaction. And he gave them a monarch that was not destined to last. King Saul only ruled for 2 years, and then he was killed in war and he was replaced. The truth of the matter is that people are, again, this is maybe a little controversial, people are not always best in the best position to choose their own leaders. I mean, basically, when you're dealing with, I mean, they didn't choose Moses, actually. You know, God chose Moses to be their leader. The Jewish people did choose to keep the Torah. They said, we will do and we will hear. But people are often not able to make that decision properly. They may be taken in by charisma, false campaign promises. In effect, spiritual leadership has to be something conferred by God. I don't think it should be something that people could just choose in that way. So I would just say that Joshua's being chosen is parallel to Moses being chosen. That, of course, you know, another point, you know, why was Joshua chosen? It's very interesting that Joshua was not only the disciple of Moshe, but Joshua used to clean up the study hall afterwards. He would put the books back in the bookcase. And the Talmud says that serving the Talmud Chacham is even greater than learning from the Talmud Chacham. So when you see books, papers thrown around, you know, if you want to clean it up and keep things orderly, you're actually doing the same mitzvah that Yehoshua did, which was the source of his merits. Now the Talmud says that Moshe was like the sun, and Yehoshua was like the moon. Now we know the moon does not reflect its own light. The moon can only reflect the light of the sun. So everything Joshua was, he got from Moses. And that also made him the ideal successor. So in Joshua, you not only have leadership, but you have modesty. You have a willingness to do things that will help the broad congregation. And you have subservience to Moshe. So those qualities identified, link, come together, and they make him the ideal leader. You know, we're entering just to, until people have questions. This Tuesday is the 17th of Tammuz, and this is the beginning of a fast and a period of 3 weeks that commemorates the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And this is a period of mourning, a period of sadness. We don't make weddings, we don't listen to music. And then as we get closer and closer to the 9th of Av, which is the actual destruction of the temple, we don't eat meat, we don't drink wine, except on Shabbos and the like. And sometimes people feel, well, what am I mourning? You know, we're still in Israel, we have Jerusalem, like, what's the big deal, etc. Well, first of all, I want to point out that, you know, we are living precariously close to a state of war right now. So if anything, God is reminding us that we still live in a very, very dangerous world. But more fundamentally, when we mourn the temple, we're really mourning the reasons why we lost the temple. And we have to rectify in our own lives those things that caused the destruction. Meaning you're not just crying over the past, but you're asking, what can I do in my own life to rebuild the temple? Now, I'm sure you've discussed this in many, many classes and in your own reading, that our sages give us reasons why the Romans destroyed the temple. Why they did it is why they did it. But why God allowed the temple to be destroyed and why God allowed the exile of the Jewish people. So our sages tell us there's a distinction between the first temple and the second temple. The first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in the year, a very long time ago, the year 586 BCE. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era by Titus. And Titus erected in Rome a triumphal arch commemorating his destruction of Jerusalem. And our sages tell us that the first temple was destroyed because of the worst possible sins. The Jewish people were guilty of idolatry. They were guilty of murder. They were guilty of adultery and incest. Those are the sins that caused the first temple to be destroyed. Why was the second temple destroyed? In the time of the second temple, most of the Jews were righteous. They kept the commandments. They studied the Torah. The Gemara says that the second temple was destroyed because of hatred and polarization and disunity that existed between the Jewish people. They were righteous. They were from. They were religious. They were Shabbos observance. But there was hatred and polarization. The Gemara then goes on and says, how long did the first exile last? Meaning, how many years was there between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple? It was only 70 years. 70 years after the destruction of the first temple, we were able to rebuild the second one. So a Chorban that occurred because of the worst possible sins, idolatry, sexual offenses, murder, it only took 70 years of galutz, and then we got it back. The second temple was destroyed because of hatred, polarization among Jews. How many years has it been since we've been in exile and the temple has been destroyed? Well, it's almost 2,000 years. The year 70 now is 2014. So we see from here a very important lesson, that hatred among Jews is even worse than idolatry and murder, and even sexual offenses. Sinas chinam, hatred. Now, hatred doesn't just mean active hatred. Hatred can have two forms. There might be hot hatred, where you're throwing rocks, you know, you're violent against a fellow Jew. But hatred can also mean indifference, coldness, lack of interest, lack of concern. When I define my community as I care about this group of people, I don't care about that group of people. They're not my people. And that is called hatred. And if we ask ourselves why we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, I think the answer is pretty clear. If the temple was destroyed because of this hatred and indifference, then it's not going to be rebuilt until we can overcome this hatred and indifference. Now, one of the positive effects of the tragedy we recently had with three boys who were brutally murdered, and even the United States, at most they said they call upon both sides to exercise appropriate restraint. Again, very, very interesting, even though one of the boys was, in fact, an American citizen, Naftali Frankel. But one of the positive benefits, one of the silver linings in this dark cloud, is that I think it did bring the Jewish people together in a way that we had not been together for a very long time. It made us realize that we are one nation. We have to care about each other. And without love of our fellow Jew, we're not going to bring Mashiach. We're not going to have the Beis HaMikdash. We're not going to have even peace in the world. You know, surveys have shown Israelis are always asked, and different every year, some newspaper has a survey, what is considered the most serious problem that is faced by the Jewish people? And across the board, whether it's ultra-Orthodox Haredim, religious Zionists, secular, whatever it is, the number one response, now there are so many things you could say. You could talk about the threat of terrorism. You could talk about nuclear war with Iran. You can talk about the economy. You can talk about water. You know, there are many, many problems Israel has. But number one problem that's identified is disunity among the Jewish people. Because everybody has an intuitive sense that if we are together, Hashem will give us the ability to deal with the problems that we have. When we're not together, we're going to be vulnerable and weak. Thomas Paine, at the time of the American Revolution, once remarked that Americans, we have to hang together, for if we don't hang together, we will surely hang separately. And that's a message that I think the Jewish people have to think about as well. You know, one of the things we know is that although, you know, again, I mean, I obviously I'm an American citizen and I'm very fond of the United States, no question. A lot of things about America I miss still. But one of the things that you learn when you're in Israel, and really you learn it as a Jew, not just an Israeli, but as a Jew, is when push comes to shove and when times are difficult, we discover, we rediscover how fundamentally alone and isolated we are in the world. And really we have no one, no human being in the world that really cares about what happens to the Jewish people. When times are okay, you know, when things are, when the pressures are not great, so we have allies and this and that. But when things get difficult, there is nobody that is with us. All we have, but of course that's a tremendous amount, we have God, which is all you need, really, and we have each other. And God's connection to us depends on our connection to each other. So, if you need something to think about, as we enter the 17th of Tammuz on Tuesday, and the 3 weeks about the destruction of the temple, these are the things you think about. How do we build the temple? We don't build the temple by bombing the Temple Mount and physically constructing the temple. Some people want to do that. Putting aside the politics, even halachically, that is not correct, because Maimonides tells us that the temple gets rebuilt after the Mashiach comes. We don't build it first. Mashiach comes, then we build the temple. So our job in building the temple is not to externally build the temple, but to prepare the ground for Mashiach coming through Avas Yisrael, Jews loving each other, caring about each other, and the like, and not letting distinctions separate us. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's going to believe the same. Obviously, you know, if you learn a page of Gemara, you know, we're filled with arguments, debates, discussions. Jews are supposed to argue. That is the Jewish way. The old joke about two Jews, there'll be at least three opinions, and usually there'll be more. So nobody is suggesting that people don't discuss, don't engage, don't debate. That is how we learn Torah. That is why we study Gemara so much. Gemara is about debating. Gemara is about process. Gemara is about discussion. Gemara doesn't give you bottom line things, because Judaism is more than bottom line. Judaism is about understanding a process. But there is a way in which people argue, people debate passionately, but they still have a fundamental love and respect for each other. And that is what we need to do, really, really. I mean, it's pretty simple, but it's much more simple to state than to do. And that's really our challenge. And that is how we bring Mashiach. That is how we bring Mashiach. That is how we bring redemption. That is how we get the Beis HaMikdash. So that's just a little bit of an introduction to what we think about during the 3 weeks, the 17th of Tammuz, and the like. I don't know if there's anyone wanted to comment or a question or
Why is it that Hashem says that, you know, you can behave like Gil Chayas as long as you're a nation? I'm relatively happy, but if you behave like gentlemen, that you hate each other, I don't want that.
Well, I wouldn't say God. I wouldn't say God is happy with being like wild animals. But the point basically is that the Jewish people can survive only when God is with us. When God is not with us, we don't survive. But God is not with individual Jews. And I, as an individual, am not deserving of having God's presence in me. It's only when I link to a whole that is greater than the sum of the parts that I am worthy of being a recipient of God's presence, because I am connected to the nation of Israel. So when we're disconnected, we are just 13 million disparate individuals. As disparate individuals, we're not worthy of God's protection. You know, I've mentioned this before. You know, there was a famous British historian, Arnold Toynbee, that perhaps you've heard of. And again, forgive me for those of you that heard this point before. And Toynbee was very famous in the 50s and 60s. He's no longer alive, and his reputation, even as a historian, has declined. But in the 50s and 60s, he was really the big guy in history. And he wrote a multi-volume work called A Study in History. And this book analyzed, actually many books, analyzed over 50 ancient civilizations. The Hittites, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, all the way to Greek and Roman, the Babylonians, the Sumerians. And imagine the amount of facts he had to master. And by examining the total picture of all of these civilizations, he was able to chart what are the factors that cause a civilization to rise, and what are the factors that cause a civilization to decline. He was able to kind of create or recognize the patterns and the laws of what you might call historical causality. A tremendous thing. And he analyzed 50 civilizations, and his theory worked 100% accurately for 49 out of the 50. The one civilization that did not fit his theory was the Jewish people. Because essentially, according to his calculations, there ought not to be Jews in the world today. Because remember, the ancient civilizations were totally, there are no Hittites or Assyrians today. And again, Toynbee pointed out that in order for a civilization to flourish, there has to be a common territory. Most of our history, we were not even living in Israel. There has to be a common language. Most Jews didn't speak Hebrew, and even today, most Jews don't speak Hebrew, etc. So basically, according to his calculation, there ought not to be a Jewish people. Now, there's nothing that irks an intellectual more than that, because you have a perfect theory that explains 99% of the data, but it doesn't explain that 1%. You get very angry. In fact, Toynbee was accused of being an anti-Semite for other things he wrote. I would suggest he became an anti-Semite because the Jewish people made his theory, you know, not work, and that's enough to make anybody an anti-Semite. There were some graduate mathematics students at MIT who wrote a brilliant paper conclusively proving through mathematical formula that bumblebees are incapable of flight because their mass relative to their wingspan was too great to permit airborne flight. So they basically proved by ironclad mathematics that bumblebees cannot fly. Those are the big fat bees. And nobody could refute the math. The only problem is bumblebees do fly. So what do you do when you have a perfect theory, and it's perfect, it's analytic, it makes sense, it's logical, but it just doesn't fit the facts? Well, intellectuals kind of say, well, forget about the facts, I have a great theory. So Toynbee had a real problem, because Toynbee couldn't figure out, why are there Jews? They ought not to be here. My law says they shouldn't be here. So because of this, Toynbee coined a phrase. He called the Jewish people a fossilized nation, meaning to say, you know, they shouldn't be here, but it's like a fossil. You find a fly trapped in amber. You might walk into a, who knows, you might walk into some forest in the Amazon and find a dinosaur. You know, who knows what you're going to find, you know, somewhere. So he says, there ought not to be Jews, but they're like fossils. And there was a big debate in college campuses. This is before you guys were born, in the 60s. Yaakov Herzog, who was an ambassador to the UN, was debating Toynbee about, are the Jews a fossilized people or not? But I'll tell you the truth. I would suggest Toynbee was correct, because if Toynbee is arguing that under normal historical processes there ought not to be a Jewish people, I would say, yeah, he's right, that the Jewish people's existence in the world is a miracle. It is not logical. In fact, the Maharal of Prague, who was a great symbolic thinker of the 1500s, he writes that is why circumcision is on the eighth day. Right? We enter into the covenant of Abraham on the eighth day. So the Maharal says there's a symbolic meaning of number eight. This is a very interesting thought. The cycle of creation is a seven-day cycle. 6 days of creation culminated in the Shabbos. So seven represents the world of nature, the created world of nature coupled with its day of rest. Eight, which is one beyond seven, represents a level of existence that transcends and supersedes the natural order. In fact, there's even an expression in English, the eighth day. The eighth day is referring to kind of a miraculous day that is beyond the normal constraints of time. It's the eighth day. Now again, superficially, we'll just look at the eighth day as Sunday, repeating the seven. But no, it's not that you're just repeating the seven. Eight is a transcendent level above nature. So the Maral says, the Jew has a covenant with God that his existence is above the laws of nature. So Toynbee is right. Toynbee analyzes, as a matter of historical causality, what exists, what flourishes, what declines. And he's right. Based on his theory, there ought not to be a Jewish people. The Jewish people's survival is miraculous. And what is our survival? Our survival is not simply surviving in some cave in Afghanistan. When I say the word survival, flourishing, accomplishing, contributing. You know, to some degree, the anti-Semites are right when they say Jews control everything. And they actually do, to some degree, in the sense that it's way out of proportion to our percentages. Now, granted, maybe we can't write a big book on Jewish stars of the NBA, although there were some. In some areas, our contributions will be less than in other areas. But in most areas of endeavor, it's way out of proportion. And the like. And again, I'm not here to do Jewish boosterism, but I think it is important to recognize that there is something very miraculous. We've been through a tremendous amount. Nations have tried to destroy us from antiquity. And in the 20th century, we have the Holocaust, which devastated 1/3 of our people, 1.5 million children, 6 million Jews. And then to this very day, we live in a world in which there is so much hostility directed against us by billions of people. And yet, the Jew still endures, the Jew accomplishes. And we believe that is because God has given us a special mission. When we talk about chosenness, it's not so much superiority, that's not the issue. The issue is not to be superior, but the issue is the responsibility that a Jew is given to make this world a better world, to bring holiness to the world, to exemplify values of morality and decency. Do we always do that? No, we don't always do that. But that simply means we don't always live up to our responsibility. I'm not going to say everything we do is always right. Obviously not. But the notion of chosenness is about responsibility. It is not about superiority. It is about assuming a role in the world in which we want to live with holiness and we want to live with morality. And therefore, one should know that people ask, why don't we have miracles like the splitting of the Red Sea today? And why doesn't God do all that stuff? The answer is, God does do that stuff in a different form. And that is, the survival of the Jewish people and the creation of a Jewish country is a great, great miracle that one could not logically have expected after all of these centuries of persecution. This is recognized by many people other than the Jews. Paul Johnson's book, of course, is predicated on this, a non-Jewish historian. The Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhists. And he is really the leader of a community in exile, because most of his community is no longer in Tibet. And his challenge is how to keep a community alive when it's been exiled from its land, right? That's his big challenge. And he goes to Jewish rabbis regularly to know how do you keep your community alive in a diaspora. And he considers Judaism to be the most helpful resource to him in dealing with the issues that he deals with. So to go backwards, this is why loving our fellow Jew is so important, because it is the Jewish nation that is the miracle of God's presence on earth. So when I disassociate myself from that nation, I don't partake of God's beneficence on Klal Yisrael, on the nation. And unfortunately, we do have a history of rivalries. You know, they say that Eskimos, because they're so attuned to snow, they can identify 300 different shades of white. Now, we wouldn't even see the big difference, but they're so sensitive to nuances. In certain cultures, they have different shades of blue that are, you know, undifferentiable by us. Well, in Israel, people can identify 300 shades of Orthodox Judaism. Meaning, in America, we see things with a very blunt eye. Well, there's Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and maybe Hasidic. And that's, so we see four colors, maybe. In Israel, you can take any one of those. Take Hasidic. You can subdivide it like 300 different ways. Take Orthodox. No, 500 different ways. Meaning, there's such a sensitivity to nuance and distinction. And that's a good thing, because that really shows people understand things very, very well. But that also means that people who are fundamentally indistinguishable from each other think that they're kind of enemies, because, you know, oh, you wear a black hat and I wear a gray hat, can't talk, our children cannot play with each other. So sometimes to be overly analytical in your definitions can be self-defeating, because then you take things that are really small and they become magnified into huge, huge, huge differences. And that's really our problem. We got to overcome that sinas chinam and know that there is much more that unites us than divides us. And only in that way we can achieve a geula, a redemption. And as I say, sometimes it happens. It happens all over the world that way, that it's tragedy that becomes the catalyst for unity. Now, I wish there would be a better way, but, you know, that happened after 9/11 in the United States, where even New Yorkers were friendly to each other. You know, that's a rarity in New York. And it happens in Israel when we have the difficulties that we face. The deaths of these three boys is a catalyst for unity, but, you know, God knows that's a very high cost to pay for that benefit. And we wish and we would hope that we could achieve the unity without having to have these tragedies to bring it forth. Okay, any other comments or whatever? Okay, all right. Okay, well, then maybe I'll let you off early today, and one more chance. I'm going once, going twice. Okay.
Mashiach.
Oh, what about Mashiach? Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, let me just explain three terms, just so you should have three Hebrew terms that you're familiar with, because sometimes people mix them up. There is the coming of Mashiach. There is the world to come. And there is resurrection of the dead. So in Hebrew, Yemos HaMashiach, the days of Mashiach, the world to come is called Olam Haba, and resurrection of the dead is called Techias HaMesim. Now, a lot of people get confused, because all of this is like, you know, the afterlife and the future, and people mix it up. But it's important to understand these are three different ideas that will happen at three different times. Olam Haba, the world to come, is not a physical world. That's the world of the soul. After you die, your soul separates from the body. The body is in the ground. The body is like the robe. The body is in the ground. And the soul gets united with God in a purely spiritual world. That exists right now. Right now there's Olam Haba. Now that would be where your great-grandparents would be or whatever it is. They're with God in Olam Haba. We say in heaven, but they're with God. That is not a physical place. There is no eating. There is no drinking. It is the spiritual communion with God, and it is said to be the greatest of all pleasures. We can't even imagine it. And even though the sages talk about eating, drinking, feasting, those are metaphors to describe indescribable spiritual pleasures. That's Olam Haba. Now, Yemot HaMashiach is going to be in this world, and that means we believe that any day now, in no case, no later than the year 6000, now this is 5,774 years, we are absolutely certain before the year 6000, but we hope, you know, today, tomorrow, you know, much earlier, we believe there will be a Mashiach. Now the word Mashiach doesn't mean God or anything. Mashiach means the anointed one. That's all it means, the anointed one. And he will come. He will be a descendant of King David. He will be a righteous prophet. He will bring all the Jews to the land of Israel, all the Jews to the land of Israel. He will rebuild the temple. and he will usher in an era of world peace. Now, according to the Rambam's description, the messianic era is not going to be supernatural. There won't be miracles. People will still die. You'll still have to work. You'll still have to, you know, get a good cell phone, whatever it would be. So life will go on, but it'll be at a very heightened level of spiritual awareness. First of all, there'll be peace in the world. That itself is pretty much of a miracle. Not everybody will be Jewish, but everybody will believe in God. In other words, the temple will be a focal point where people will come to worship God, even if they're not going to be Jewish, and they'll only keep the seven Noahide laws. In fact, we don't even accept converts to Judaism once Mashiach comes. The door gets closed. You have to want to become a Jew when things are hard for the Jewish people, not when the Jewish people have a lot of advantages. And people will still die, and Mashiach will be succeeded by son of Mashiach. In other words, it'll be a dynasty, so to speak. And that is the days of Mashiach. And when people die, their soul will still go to Olam Haba. Now, at some point, towards the end of this messianic era, and we don't know if that's 1,000 years or whatever it'll be, God is then going to take all the souls in Olam Haba, put them back into the bodies, and there will be resurrection of the dead. And that'll be eternal. And essentially what that's doing is, that's bringing Olam Haba into Olam Hazeh, creating a harmonic union of the physical and the spiritual worlds, and that will be the ultimate reward for the righteous people. Techiyas HaMesim, that is the end stage. So these are three different stages. Olam Haba exists right now. Yemos HaMashiach will be in this physical world. Techiyas HaMesim will be the reunification of the body and the soul, bringing us back to the Garden of Eden, where we should have been in the first place had we not taken that 6,000-year detour away from the Garden of Eden. Techiyas HaMesim brings us back to that spiritual existence, even within the confines of the physical body. Now, obviously, resurrection of the dead is a miracle, because most bodies would have decomposed. Right? So it's not a natural process in any way, but it will happen. Now, there are questions. Not everybody merits resurrection of the dead, and there are issues about who gets it, who doesn't get it. If one does not believe in resurrection of the dead, one does not benefit from it. What you don't believe in, you don't get. But nevertheless, because of another doctrine, which is reincarnation, it may very well be that each of us comes back numerous times until we fix our lives. So the point basically is, if a person dies not believing in things, he comes back again and is given repeated chances, like Groundhog Day, you know, etc. And therefore, the idea would be eventually everybody is given many, many chances so they could merit that final Olam Haba and resurrection. Yeah. Okay, so I would say this. If it doesn't come, then we'll just say that we made a mistake in our calculation. Meaning to say the following. It's important to differentiate between what are called articles of faith and opinions that are expressed in rabbinic literature. Meaning to say, an article of faith is what we would call a dogma. It is a fixed, absolute belief of Judaism, and Judaism rises and falls upon it. Now, belief in the Mashiach is a fundamental principle of Judaism. However, belief in the timing of the Mashiach is really a matter of different opinions that are expressed. The most common opinion that is expressed is that the outer limit of the Mashiach is the year 6000, and they base it on the following argument, that there are 6 days of creation followed by a Shabbos. So too, there will be 6 millennia of history followed by the universal Shabbos, which is the Messianic era. So based on that analogy, that is where they get the year 6000. However, that is not an article of faith per se. That is a view that is expressed in rabbinic literature, but Judaism does not rise or fall on that. So it's what I believe, and I think it's what the mainstream belief, but if that doesn't happen, we'll just say Mashiach will come later. That's all. So it's not a fundamental belief in that way. On the other hand, if you were to deny Mashiach, that would be a fundamental denial. Yeah.
What is the end of the Acharit HaYamim?
So that's an interesting point. Okay, so I gave you three terms: Olam Haba, Yemosu Mashiach, Tchias HaMesim. Now you are correct that there are a number of other terms that are used: Acharit HaYamim, the end of days; Liatid Lavo, the future. These terms are vague, and here's the problem: they could mean any one of the three, and it depends on the context. So you have to be careful. We have specific terms, and then we have kind of generic apocalyptic terms, which can be defined differently depending on the context. Sometimes the Atid Lavo is Mashiach, sometimes it's Tchias HaMesim, sometimes it's Olam Haba. Well, we believe that God, of course, made the universe, not just the earth. And certainly in the writings of the sages, there are intimations of intelligent life, although in a manner different than you're describing it. The sages actually describe planets and stars as having some sense of consciousness and intelligence. Now, even if you don't accept that, though, perhaps they might be referring indirectly to extraterrestrial life. So I think that we would believe that there is a possibility of such life, but we would also...
Intelligent life. Not like a bacteria.
That's no, that's correct. But I think our theology compels that the human being on planet Earth is the ultimate purpose of creation. Meaning to say, it would be difficult for us to assimilate the idea of an alternative, autonomous civilization. We would believe somehow that the purpose of these higher worlds were to somehow serve the human condition by creating blessing or whatever. Because I think it is pretty clear in Jewish theology that man is the pinnacle.
Regardless of what else does happen.
Yes. So we would have to interrogate. Right now we don't yet have the challenge because we haven't been confronted with it. But that would be a challenge. You know, as you know, though, it's interesting that when Copernicus discovered or attempted to prove that the Earth revolves around the Sun instead of the Sun revolving around the Earth, there were many Christian theologians that had a lot of trouble with Copernicus. And their argument was that since man is the purpose and center of creation, then everything has to revolve around us. And therefore, for the Earth to revolve around the Sun is detracting from the centrality of man. Now, it's interesting, Judaism didn't have so much of a problem. You will not find Jewish opposition to Copernicus. We kind of just ran with it and assimilated. So apparently, we're not so concerned with our physical place in the universe, but I think we are concerned with our spiritual place in the universe, and that would be something that would have to be confronted. One more question, yeah.
I had a question. A rabbi told me a long time ago, not too long ago, but he said that we actually could rebuild the temple. There's not a lot of reason why we couldn't other than political.
Okay, so again, two Jews, three opinions. I mean, meaning to say, there actually is, and I don't just mean my personal opinion. There actually is in halakhic literature a great discussion about this point. Maimonides rules that the temple cannot be rebuilt until the coming of the Mashiach. So according to Maimonides, we cannot. However, to be honest, there is another opinion. And the other opinion is also from an authoritative source. It is from the Jerusalem Talmud that actually says building the temple precipitates the coming of Mashiach. It's like that movie saying, build it and they shall come, right? So it's exactly it. Build it and it shall come. So I can say that there are two fundamental views in Jewish rabbinic literature, which find their expression even in contemporary political debate, whether is it our job to build the temple and bring the Mashiach, or is it that we wait until the Mashiach comes, then we bring the temple. Most rabbis do follow the view of Maimonides. There are some groups in Israel who are religious groups, the Temple Mount faithful, who actually believe that we have to build a temple in spite of the political problems. So the view that you heard does have some authority, but I say it is not accepted by the mainstream based on Maimonides. Okay? All right, you all take care. Have a good Shabbos.